Hey everybody. So there's a lot of people out there, a lot of men in particular, that do not like the 21st century. They don't like living in modernity. You know, they kind of wish that they could go back in time 30 years, 50 years, 100 years, you know, that sort of thing. And I think what they do is they think, maybe not so much that they wish they could go back in time, but I do think that there's a lot of people who at some point in their lives have thought to themselves, like, you know, was I born at the ideal time? What if I'd been born into a different society at a different period of time? Would I have been better off? Okay, I think most people have probably thought that at some point. However, when people tend to do this, they generally tend to think of hypothetical scenarios when they could have been born in like a better time. All right, but what I think some people don't do is they don't think about the other side of the coin. Like, what if you'd been born into like a peasant society? You know, what if you'd been born into like some awful time, you know, the Dark Ages or whatever? Well, as it turns out, I've been listening to a book this last couple of weeks or whatever since I made my last video. I've been listening to an audiobook. You know, I love audiobooks, man. If there was one type of content that I would like, you know, if I could only choose one genre of content on YouTube, it would be audiobooks. You know, if I could only listen to one genre ever again, there's enough of them out there, and I'm talking about free ones as well, to like sustain me for years. Anyway, one of the reasons why I haven't been making videos lately is I have been like gearing up for my next overseas trip, right? Like getting my passport organized and just, you know, wrapping things up, right? And while I've been driving around and doing everything I need to do, I've been listening to an audiobook, which I had started once before, but I'd only listened to the first part of it because it's a massive book. It's called The Gulag Archipelago. I remember years ago, CRP did a video talking about it, and I think Jordan Peterson also referenced it. Okay, it's written by a guy by the name of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and it's a huge, I think it's like a three massive books that make one giant book. The guy that wrote it, Solzhenitsyn, he wrote it during the Soviet regime in Russia, okay? He wrote it as a former Gulag inmate, okay? The Gulags were the Soviet concentration camps, particularly bad under Stalin, but they lasted the full length of the Soviet regime. From Lenin right through to the early 90s, the Gulag system was in place. And Solzhenitsyn, while under the Soviet dictatorship, under the Soviet regime in the early 1970s or, you know, late 60s, he wrote this book about the Soviet Union, you know, painting it in a very bad light while living in Russia at the time. And he had to hide out in like a farmhouse or whatever, and he was hunted by the KGB. It's the story of the book is a story in and of itself, but that's neither here nor there. So the story of the novel itself, the story of the Gulag Archipelago, is as follows, okay? And of course, it's all based on a true story. Well, not just a true story. It's a novel not so much about Solzhenitsyn's experience as a Zek, which was a prisoner of the Gulag in the 1940s and 50s, but it's a history of the Gulag system itself, okay? He used hundreds of first-hand sources, and yeah, it's a deep dive into the Gulag system in Russia under the Soviet Union. But obviously, because he was a prisoner himself, he touches heavily on his own experiences. And the novel begins with his life before the arrest, okay? So he was a World War II Eastern Front soldier, okay? He was quite high-ranking. He was actually a decorated officer on the Eastern Front during World War II. Now, for those of you who know nothing about, like, the purges and everything, for those of you who know nothing about the purges or the Gulag system or what it was like under Soviet rule, the Soviet leaders, okay, the dictators, not just Stalin, but all of them from 1919 through to, you know, 1991, all of the Soviet leaders had a certain percentage of the Soviet population. And of course, this peaked under Stalin with around 10% of the population, but there was always a trickle of this, What they did is they arrested a certain percentage of the Russian population under the guise that they were, you know, agitators, and put them into concentration camps. And the reason why they did this is because the Soviet economy needed the slave labor. You see, everyone knows that the Soviet Union went bankrupt, basically, in the late 80s, but it nearly went under in the 1950s because the prime minister at the time in the 1950s, Nikita Khrushchev, he, in a process called de-Stalinization, he released so many of the concentration camp prisoners, he released so many of the Czechs, that it actually threatened to bankrupt the economy because that entire structure needs the slaves in order to survive. Anyway, so in 1945, Solzhenitsyn was a frontline officer on the Eastern Front. Okay, so it's the end of World War II. The Russians had made it all the way as far as Germany. They hadn't quite made it to Berlin when Solzhenitsyn was arrested, but they'd entered the German territory when all of a sudden Solzhenitsyn was arrested because the NKVD, which is like the private, kind of like the Gestapo of the Soviet Union, they found a letter he had sent to a friend that had some very mild criticism of Stalin. And for that, he was given what was the standard punishment at the time, 10 years in prison. I think he only served 8, but he got what they called a tenor, a 10-year prison sentence for counter-revolutionary behavior. Basically, any criticism of Stalin would get you a 10-year sentence in those days. So he got transported from Germany all the way back to Moscow. So he was escorted by the predecessors to the KGB, who were much worse than the KGB, called the NKVD. And these guys were horrific, okay? Like, everybody's heard of the Gestapo being banned. Well, people that experienced the NKV and the Gestapo, and there were many people in those labor camps that had spent time under both regimes, and they said that the Gulag under the NKVD was actually worse than being in the concentration camps or the Gestapo holding cells. Anyway, I'll try not to bore you guys with, you know, too much detail here. I'll try not to send you to sleep with a history lesson, but suffice to say that Solzhenitsyn was taken to these punishment cells where he was interrogated for several months. And I use the word interrogate as a euphemism for the most horrific physical and psychological torture that, you know, a person can undergo without, you know, kicking the bucket, basically. And they would watch you 24/7 to prevent you from self-deleting, okay? Like, every second of the day, they would watch you because so many people would rather escape the interrogation techniques than actually be alive to experience it. Because they needed the confessions, okay? They needed the confessions for the slave labor, and they couldn't send them to the Gulag without a confession. So they would undergo people to, you know, the worst punishments that your brain can conceive of. All right, Solzhenitsyn talked about one where they would starve an inmate they would starve him right down to the bone, and then they would hold him down with his sciatic nerves now like exposed due to starvation. They would hold him down as a skeleton, and they would ram a rod directly against his sciatic nerve, which would send thunderclap bolts of pain right throughout the body, like enough to pass out from just one blow of pain. And your entire body would swell up from just one blow, and they would do blow after blow after blow. And then you'd pass out because of the pain. They'd carry you back to the bedbug cell. See, they'd carry you back to the bedbug cell where you'd get bitten by thousands of bedbugs, because that was another technique they used. And then the next morning, they'd drag you out for another session of sciatic nerve blows. So, you know, that sort of stuff, right? Day after day after day for 3 months. Anyway, it was into this environment of torture that Solzhenitsyn was sent to in 1945 for having sent a letter to a friend that was mildly critical of Stalin, where he underwent 3 months of interrogation. You know, they used all sorts of methods on him, and he eventually confessed to counter-revolutionary behavior. You know, whatever they needed him to sign, he signed it, and he was sentenced to 10 years in the Gulag. Now, the Gulag is not like you might think, oh, well, you know, at least once you get to the camp, you can just keep your head down for 10 years or 25 years or whatever they sentence you to. You, at least you can just keep your head down, do the work, and you'll be okay. But that wasn't the case at all, okay? First of all, they mixed real criminals in with the political prisoners, and the very first day he got there, he got robbed by, like, gangs of hardened Russian criminals from the 1940s, you know, like, tatted-up gangsters that ruled the prison. So as soon as you get there, you're automatically victimized by the inmates and by the guards. In fact, the way it worked is in the early days of the Gulag, the general inmates were under directive to harass the political prisoners because the regular inmates would come and go, like, you know, they'd get sentenced to prison and then get released, whereas the point of the political prisoners was for them to perish in the gulags because they didn't want people doing memoirs about it and stuff once they got out. So the nearer you got to the end of your sentence as a political prisoner, the more they tried to work you literally until you died, basically. You know, they'd up your, you know, your work day from 12 hours to 16 hours, and they'd put you into the mines, and they'd do the worst possible things they could do to break you, okay? And the only reason why Solzhenitsyn managed to survive the whole affair, he was one of not that many who actually survived the Gulag system, because he was sent to a relatively, you know, a camp, but by labor camp standards, was survivable. Like, there was no such thing as a good camp, okay? There were no camps that were good, but the one that Solzhenitsyn got sent to, I think 2 years into his sentence, was one where the political prisoners were separated from the general population. It was like a specific camp for political prisoners. So that kind of lifted their spirits a little bit, because they're now surrounded by their own, you know, comrades kind of thing. And the camp was run by bureaucrats rather than out-and-out sadists. So, you know, he was just kind of able to keep his head down for 8 years and do the work. And he was eventually released into exile. But yeah, it's a great book. It's honestly, it's just such a great novel. It gets a little bit of a slog in the middle parts, because he goes into, like, the deep history of the Gulag, but there are timestamps throughout the video, so if you want to skip a section, you can just skip it, because people in the comments section were posting, like, timestamps, so if you just want to listen to the escape stories and whatnot, you can skip ahead a little bit. But anyway, I'm not expecting people to listen to a 1,500-page book on my recommendation. What I was going to say, though, what sort of prompted me to go ahead and make this video or to talk about this topic is, it's a very interesting book, and there's lots of different parts of it I could talk about. But the thing that really sort of got me thinking, like, really kind of, like, well, you know, followed me, you know, once I stopped listening, I was, you know, just driving around and, you know, waiting at the post office and just doing my passport application, all of the stuff that I've been doing this last couple of weeks. The part that really kind of stuck with me is there is a section in the middle of the book where Solzhenitsyn is transferred from one gulag to another gulag, and they have to travel by train. He's under an escort. I don't remember why they made them do this, but the NKVD, again, they're like the former KGB, they did this thing where when they would transport a prisoner, he would be told to act natural, like nothing's going on. I think it's because they like to operate in secret as much as possible. So he was told to act natural, even though he's a prisoner. And they're watching him the whole time, but he takes a seat in one of the carriages where he's sort of sitting away from them a little bit. And as he's sitting there, he can hear people on the train, just regular normies on their way somewhere, sitting in, you know, small groups. He can hear them talking about just mundane aspects of their life, right? And keep in mind, he is, you know, he's been through an experience so bad, no one listening to me right now will ever understand the difficulty that, you know, of what it was like to go through the Russian gulag for a number of years at that point that he'd already been through. And he's on the train just listening to people talking about mundane topics, like, you know, he heard two women talking about a mother-in-law that they didn't get along with, or you know, they could hear people talking about a relative who has been offered a job in Moscow but isn't sure if they want to move across the country. And at that point in time, he feels like there's such an enormous chasm between them, right? There's such an enormous gap in these normies' understanding of the hell that, you know, he's been through versus the tiny, petty nothingness that they're having to deal with. Like, he just wants to scream, but he knows that the mental space separating them from him is incommunicable. He wants to scream that, like, the true measure of life is so far beyond these petty difficulties that you experience on a daily basis, right? Like, you know, for him, getting an extra spoonful of gruel or an extra piece of moldy wet bread once a day is like a huge win, right? Like, there's interpersonal politics within the camp for weeks on end as to who gets an extra blanket. Like, you know, they fight and they compete in the gulag for the most tiny morsels of not even creature comfort, but you get what I'm talking about, right? Like, the struggle of the gulag compared to these people on the train who are just talking about, you know, he heard someone say that they're really irritated by one of their communal neighbors not wiping their feet in the hallway, like that sort of stuff, right? Like, the difficulty that he faces versus what they're talking about is so hugely different that he had never felt so isolated from the human race before. But anyway, the reason why I'm making this video, so I know this is not like my most action-packed video, it's kind of, like most of my videos, it kind of comes across as like morbid. You know, people probably think I'm more black-pilled than I actually am. The video comes across as black-pilled, but if anything, after I finished reading this book, I was filled with just like appreciation, you know. It's very white-pilling, and there's so much of the book that's white-pilling because of the way Solzhenitsyn writes. He has this energy, and, you know, I think it was JP, or it might have been Coach, who said that, you know, his books are so filled with life, even though he talks about these dark topics. But, you know, he's on this train and he's talking about how disconnected he is from these people, these normies. And, you know, he just wants to shout at them, like, don't you realize that your lives are worth living? Don't you realize that it doesn't matter if someone in your communal hallway uses the electric power socket, or, you know, do you realize it doesn't matter if people cut you off in traffic? Like, these things don't matter. That you don't have to travel with a convoy. You know, you don't have to line up against a wall. And this is something that other Russian authors have pointed out, that, you know, in the West, we pursue happiness. We spend decades toiling away to get riches or to get, you know, social promotions. When, if you're not sitting around starving, feeling thirsty, you know, if you're not freezing cold in the snow, then you have nothing to want for. In fact, let me find the quote. All right, here's a bit of the section that I was talking about. In the deep, deaf stillness of the night, the doors of the death cells are being swung open, and great souled people are being dragged out to be shot. On the railroads of the country this very minute, right now, people who have just been fed salt herring are licking their lips dry with bitter tongues. They dream of the happiness of stretching out one's legs and the relief one feels from going to the toilet. The earth thaws only in summer, and only to the depth of 3 feet, and only then can they bury the bones of those that have died in the winter. And you have the right to arrange your own life under the blue sky and under the hot sun, to get a drink of water, to stretch, to travel anywhere you want without a convoy. So what's this about unwiped feet? And what's this about a mother-in-law? What about the main thing in life, all of its riddles? It is enough if you don't freeze in the cold, and if thirst and hunger don't claw at your insides, if your back isn't broken, if your feet can walk, if your arms can bend, and both eyes can see, and if both ears can hear, and whom should you envy, and why? Our envy of others devours us most of all. I didn't do that justice. But yeah, hopefully you understand the sort of the overall point, that I'm sort of making thus far in this video, which is that there is a wisdom that comes from people who have suffered. And I mean real suffering, not, you know, working a bad job or not being able to find a girlfriend, some other, you know, petty injustice that might seem like a big deal, especially when you're young, but isn't really the big injustice. It isn't really the suffering that is comparable to what the Zeks, that's the people who went through the gulag for 10 years, 20 years, some were sentenced to a quarter, which is 25 years, you know, compared to what they went through. It's kind of a hard thing to put into words, but you know how like people like drug addicts are always chasing a high? It's like everyone all over the developed world is constantly chasing a high. You know, just having a full stomach and not being in pain isn't good enough, right? They have to find quote-unquote happiness, you know? they have to find some additional meaning or whatever. In fact, there's a section of the book, there's a section of the Gulag Archipelago where Solzhenitsyn hands the novel over to an escapee. So, you know, in essence, several chapters are written not by Solzhenitsyn, but by this escapee who told his story in the first hand. So Tenno was an inmate who was sentenced to 25 years in the Gulag, and he was what they call a committed escaper, someone who decided from the day they got sentenced, well, before that, actually, he was conspiring to attack his interrogator. Like, from the time he got arrested, he's like, you know, I will never, ever, ever stop trying to escape. Like, that's, you know, every waking second will be dedicated to escaping, you know, like the show Prison Break. Like, every waking thought is all about escaping. Right, he was that kind of guy. Anyway, after several years, he eventually did, after, you know, meticulous planning and several failed attempts, he eventually did escape. It was him and another dude who escaped together. You know how they say that the human body can go 3 days without water? Well, him and his friend, him and his escapee, went 5 days without any water, and they were literally on the brink of death, right? They were right there on the brink of death after 5 days with no water. Right, like they literally had to lie down in the steppe. The steppe is this kind of like vast expanse of grassland with just nothing as far as the eye can see. It's just grass, basically. No mountains, nothing. Just, you know, endless horizon of short grass. They were in the steppe, and they had to lie down in the steppe for 12 hours in the daytime so no one spotted them, in the blistering sun, because it was like the end of summer. Right, like nothing to drink for 5 days straight. And on the brink of death, they eventually decided to approach what's called an urt, or a yurt, sorry. It's a traditional Kazakh-style, like, dwelling, right? Like a hut. And, you know, they go in there and they beg for food and water. The guy that was in there was kind of inhospitable, so they kind of tied him up, basically, and took what they needed. They took a bucket of water and some scraps of food, and they took one of his horses. And as they're riding along on horseback, he describes it as being like the most euphoric moment of his life. Like, you know, he will never want for anything ever again because he has a full stomach and he's free. He's a free man. Okay, they'd only been free for 5 days, but he was free at that moment. And he had never been happier in his entire life up until that moment. And yeah, I don't know. Maybe people aren't buying it. Maybe people listening find this topic boring or kind of trite. But I think that there is some power to that, you know. And it's like that, you know, like on The Sopranos, right, where Tony wakes up from his coma and he promises himself that he's going to stop to smell the roses, as he puts it. But then he later describes in season six that, you know, you wake up and you say to yourself that every day is a gift, but then the tedious kind of dramas of everyday life has a way of chipping away at it. Well, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't need to, you know? You only allow things to annoy you if you allow them to annoy you. Like, after Solzhenitsyn was released and he's in exile, he's, you know, he's living on like a few pennies a month, basically, that he gets directly from the KGB. You know, he's in exile. He's being paid pennies per day, basically, to live on. He's living in a tiny little hut in some Kazakh village where he's been exiled to. And he's happier than he's been ever in his life. You know, he gets to sit in his tiny little hovel, which was basically a hut, kind of like a yurt. Yeah, he's in a tiny little hut all day, just writing poetry, and he's free. He's never been happier. And I don't know, I just think that there's a lot to be gained from that. And yeah, that's why I'm so looking forward later this year when I get to go on my next big trip, which will be a lot longer this time. And, you know, for people who don't understand, like, why I would do what I'm doing, I've tried to explain it before, but, well, as Solzhenitsyn said, you know, there is so much to be said for the ability to travel, all right, the ability to just travel anywhere you want that's within your means, okay, and not have to have a convoy of guards with you, you know, there's so much to be said for that, all right, you know, for billions of years before we were born, there was nothing. And then we're born and we get to see the world for 60 to 80 years or whatever. You know, we don't know how long we've got to see it, but we get to be awake for like what is in the grand scheme of, you know, existence, a blip, okay? Not even a second, a few seconds of time that we're awake for. And then we go back to sleep for all eternity. Wouldn't you want to make the most of the few seconds of existence that you're awake? For billions of years, you weren't awake, and you're going to go back to sleep. And, you know, in less than half a century, you're going to go back to sleep for all of eternity. So you may as well live it up while you got the chance, man. And again, it sounds, as I'm talking, I can hear my own words, and I'm like, man, this sounds kind of trite compared to the book itself, okay? I'm not doing Solzhenitsyn justice, okay? I'm taking a 1,500-page book that's written by one of, like, the best author, certainly one of the best Russian authors of all time, and I'm condensing it down into, like, a 30-minute video with my Spurgy narration. It doesn't have the same merit, okay? You got to listen to the book to really understand what I'm talking about. I'm not giving life advice. I'm just talking about the thoughts that I had secondhand from Solzhenitsyn's words, man. I thought it was pretty impactful. I thought it was a good book. And that's what I've been listening to these last couple of weeks. And I love to share these things with you guys when I get the opportunity to. And as for me, I am pretty much kind of set to head off again. I'm not going to be heading off in the next month or two. I'm just going to keep working. I kind of put like a ballpark of June the 1st. That's like my rough kind of, I've got a couple of visas that I'm applying for at the moment, and I'm just sort of waiting to see how those go. So I'm pretty confident, but you know, it depends on what visas I get and when they're set to commence. There's like a few different variables to take into account. So June the 1st is my target, but September the 1st is my backup target. I'm almost certain, I'm almost like 100% certain that I am qualified, like just by default, for several visas that I've applied for. Like, you know, I have the funds and everything. I have the minimum amount in your bank account to show that you're self-sufficient. I meet all of the visa check marks for the countries that I've like applied for or are considering applying for. So I'm pretty confident, but worst comes to worst, I'll just tourist visa my way around. Who knows? Oh, and I'll probably document my trip a lot more this time, like as it's happening. And I'll probably do it on like a separate channel. You know, there's quite a market for that type of stuff on YouTube. I know it's played out, and like every single like hipster, like normie-con loves to post their travels. But, you know, if you're willing to go to some of the more like hardcore areas, which is like what I like to do, then there's actually quite a market for that. Like there's like a video that's got like millions of views of some guy walking through the ghetto in Manila. You know, I'm not saying that'll happen to me, but it's like, yeah, at least there's a market out there for it. So I might do like I might actually film some of it as I go along. Not like to clickbait, but just, you know, to document it so I can send it home to people who are interested. But anyway, we'll see how it goes.